Yes, Prabhu, some questions.
Yes, Maharaj. In fine arts, we can find a term, pentimento.
What is it?
Pentimento. I will explain it.
Portamento?
Pentimento.
Oh, pentimento.
This Italian word means an alteration in a painting, evidenced by traces of previous work. Oh. In one of your lectures, you also used the synonymous word palimpsest. So, which means something reused or altered by, but still bearing visible traces of its earlier form. Mm-hmm. So, the similar phenomenon we can observe in history of Vedic earlier form, or in history of Vedic literature. So, my question is,
what is observable in Vedic
this
literature?
This similar phenomenon we can observe.
What's an example of that?
Yeah, so my question is, how Vedic literature, which descends from the infinite source and being immaculate, can be colored with finite mental impressions of imperfect jiva souls?
Oh, I see. Well, first of all, when I was using the term palimpsest, I was using that in relation to sangskar. Because sangskar actually means, well, it means different things, but in the context I was using it, it means mental impressions. And it's sometimes taken to mean mental impressions that have been accumulated lifetime after lifetime. So if you think of the mind as some sort of a subtle canvas, one impression, another impression, another impression, another impression. So Srila Guru Maharaj sometimes refers to this as acquired prejudice and acquired tendency. Because we live in an age defined where self-expression is defined by the selfie. Right? So ostensibly, I'm putting that under the heading of what is obvious, self-expression. But the point can be made that what is that self that is being expressed? Is it a self that, from a Vedic perspective, we understand as buried under layers and layers of acquired tendencies and acquired prejudice? Or sangskar, so many mental impressions after so many lifetimes. So is it, in that sense, true expression? And since we're on the subject of art, or even in a peripheral way, when critics speak of artists and their paintings, and particularly masterworks, not all the time, but often we will hear them say things like, well, they will use terms like, it approaches the divine, or there was such a total absence of ego in this painting that it was a pure expression of aesthetic beauty. Something along these lines. And just taking it in this context that what they say is true or has some merit, then what they're telling us is that when you can, as an artist, using that term broadly, if you can eliminate your ego and your acquired prejudice and acquired tendencies and offer yourself as a medium of pure expression, then that's, high art, or the artist under the influence of the muse, or in other words, they like to laud works that appear to be egoless as far as possible. While at the same time, the biographers will say, these artists have such gigantic egos. And they wrote books some years back. Now it wouldn't be a scandal in modern context, but 20, 30 years ago where these series of biographies on artists, and people were shocked to find out they weren't exactly nice guys. Because they were saying, how could someone, produce such a beautiful work and be such a in some cases, contemptible person, right? And that makes another point by inference. So I was speaking of it in that way. And what you're saying reminds me of what's dealt with in the Bhagavad Gita, what's also dealt with in the Uddhava Gita, the 11th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, which is how, I forget how you said it here, but what was originally pure or something along those lines, you know, divine revelation. Let's say it began in utter purity. Right? How is it possible that it can become something less than that? Is that possible? Does that happen? So in Bhagavad Gita, we hear that it happens from no less an authority than Krishna. In the 4th chapter, Imam Vivasvate Yogam Proktavan Aham Avyayam Vivasvan Manave Praha Manur Ikshvakave Bravit. Where Krishna is saying something that's startling. And think of the context again. They're on the battle of field of Kurukshetra. These massive armies are assembled. The war of all wars is about to begin. And Krishna is saying in this instance that this science of yoga, but at Guru Maharaj says it means more specifically karma yoga, but that's a side point, what he's saying. But this revelation, let's say here, he said, I originally spoke to the sun god, Vivaswan, and then Vivaswan to his son, Ikshaku, and a line descended from there. Arjuna is very surprised to hear that. He's thinking, that's like millions and millions of years ago. How could you speak that to the sun god? You're my contemporary. Remember, Arjuna is under the influence of Yoga Maya. He is a vehicle for asking these questions. And Krishna says in one place, Bahuni me vyatitani janmani tava charjana. You and I have been born many, many times, Arjuna. I know all of them. Not only mine, but I know all of yours too. So he's saying, in another incarnation, I spoke this to Vivaswan. I mean, this is significant. At first, it wouldn't be in Bhagavad Gita if it wasn't. So it's significant in many different ways. One thing, again, who is this Krishna who is speaking, who not once does it say, Sri Krishna Uvacha, that Sri Krishna said. It always says, Sri Bhagavan Uvacha, the Blessed Lord, or God said, to remind us who is speaking. But here, the follow-up verse to the one I just quoted, he says, Eva, and so referring to that line from Krishna to Vivaswan, the sun god, to Maharaj Ikshaku, and he says, Evam Parampara Praptam, a parampara was established. Means a line of descent of divine revelation, a disciplic line of descent. Parampara. Evam parampara praptam imam rajarshio vidu. And the great rajarshis, these spiritual kings, they understood this and passed it down. Sakalaneha mahata. Yoga nashta parantapa. And here the word yoga means the link, the chain, nashta. It was broken. So therefore I'm speaking it again. So no less than Krishna himself is acknowledging that even divine revelation, even from him, can become something less than that in time. Or, as expressed by Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he says in his Bhagavad speech in the introductory section that, and I'm paraphrasing, but not by much, he said, the truth inevitably, invariably, is converted into error or falsity. Again, that's startling to believers. But then he says, therefore, continual revelation is necessary to restore the truth to its former purity. So that means in each age there may be revelation. It will not always be, 5,000 years ago or 500 years ago. But the idea, so, and nothing since then? Or 2,000 years ago, or however many millions of years ago. Any revelation recently or contemporary revelation? And not to call anything and everything revelation. Like Prabhupada was once speaking about the generic piety of the people of India. And he says, the only country in the world, he said, where if a bogus person declares himself an incarnation of God, that 10,000 people will assemble to hear him speak. So not that anything and everything is, you said there must be each age, this occurred to me. Not that anything and everything is revelation. Right? Sadhu, Shastra, Guru, Vaishnav, there are ways of verifying things. So that is Krishna's determination in Bhagavad Gita. But again, it's revisited in the Uddhava Gita, in the 11th canto of the Bhagavatam, and the sloka that mentions these words, parampara jena prakriti by chitrad. And there that word parampara is used again. This line of descent, a disciplic line of descent. And here it says, prakriti by chitrad means, in Guru Maharaj's words, that the truth is expressed, there's this divine revelation, and then it is modified according to the temperament of the recipients. This is very important to understand. So we're sometimes told, Brahma to Narada, right, and his son's disciples. And they're of different mindset, so they're all hearing one truth, and according to their individual temperament, it's becoming modified. And then disciplic lines are descending from them. And again, in Srila Guru Maharaj's words, and he said, and what do we have now? What has devolved from that? A religious jungle, right, of competing interpretations and such things. And Guru Maharaj's praise of Bhaktivinoda Thakur and the Bhaktivinoda Viraha Dasakam. The verse that began, dharmas chaiva gato satata bogaschit bogaschit bogatmako, something I forget. Anyway, we consider that Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur course-corrected Gaudiya Vaishnavism, which after the time of Mahaprabhu gradually deviated into various Sahajya Sampradayas, imitationists. It was Totaram Babaji who identified, 14 Sahajya Sampradayas, and Bhaktivinoda Thakur accepted his analysis and classification, right? Owl, bowl, Sahajya, Sakibeki, Kartabaja, Shani, I forget all the names. And that was at the time. There may be hundreds now. But at the time, he identified 14 specific groups of Sahajiyas, or imitationists, counterfeit lions. So we understand the great Vaishnavas who were pure in their representation were, for the most part, unknown or inaccessible. And it's Bhaktivinoda Thakur who course-corrected the line. And as expressed in the poem of Srila Guru Maharaj, Guru Dham, Granta Dham, Gora Dham, Nama Dham, Uda, Bhakti Vidham, Bhakti, Bhakti, Vinoda Dham, Bhakti, Buri Dham Bande, Bhakti Vinoda, Bhakti Vinoda Dham Sada. Mm-hmm. That what is the gift of Bhaktivinoda Thakur? That he reveals the abode of Navadvip, gives us all of our books, Granta Dham, reprints in perfect form, Srimad Bhagavatam, Chaitanya Charitamritam. He gives so many original works, Gaura Dham, that's Navya, Bhakti Dham, pure devotion, Buri Dham Bhani, Bhakti Vinoda Dham Sada. And what was the first thing mentioned? Guru. And he gives us Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur as the agent of distribution of all of these things. And every lion in the world today that has a reasonable or substantial claim to Gaudiya Vaishnavism descended from Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur. So, modification according to individual temperament. Srila Bhakti Saranga Goswami Maharaj, what is it called? Simhavaloka. He said whenever he would visit Guru Maharaj and come to be like recalibrated in a sense. The Simhavaloka means the look of the lion. The lion walks and then turns and then turns. He said, so as we would go away, we look back to see, are we still in line with Srila, Sridhar Maharaj, Guru Maharaj's conception? And then we proceed and we're always checking to make sure that our integrity of the fidelity of our representation is there. So it means that one has to be vigilant. Every disciple has to be vigilant about what they've heard. And what they reproduce for others. And we see after the departure of great acharyas, different opinions evolve about what is the central teaching, what is most important, what is peripheral. And this is not just something that we have to deal with, but we're told the sons of Advaita Acharya, 6, 3 we consider bona fide, 3 not. The 3 and the not section did not properly conceive Nityananda Prabhu and his grace. In some instances, not even Mahaprabhu. They take Advaita as being in a superior position to Mahaprabhu himself or Nityananda. And they're sons of Advaita Acharya. So what to speak of others? Whereas the son, Achyutananda, he's a disciple of Gadadhar Pandit. Right. And most pure in his following and representation. There's a common exercise that teachers of journalism do in the class. Say there's four rows of 10 students each. And the teacher will tell the first, whisper something to the first student on this side. And then say, turn around and whisper that to the next student, and do the next, and then they go up and down the row and all the way to the end. And then at the very end, they take the first student and the last student and have them repeat what was told to them. And usually at that point, the class breaks out in laughter because it has changed so many times into something so far removed from what was originally expressed. So in, again, fourth chapter, same subject, Krishna saying, yada yada hi dharmasya glanir bhavati bharata abhyutanam adharmasya tadatmanam srijamyaham. Although he's appearing repeatedly, he says, you know, I come age after age, but when there's a rise in irreligion and a decline in religion, and we can apply that to conceptualization, when what is going on in the name of religion is so far removed from what it was meant to be at that time, he either comes personally or empowers an agent, like Shaktavesh, means divine empowerment. Again, for a course correction. Now, someone might think, oh, well, this is depressing. You know, so you're telling us, like, this, it just goes off all the time. Repeatedly, this happens. That part is, disappointing or disconcerting. But as Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, the good news is this means there must be continual revelation to restore the truth to its former purity. So when I read this in Bhagavad Gita as a teenager, I found it endearing. And it made my blossoming belief firmer, because I thought, oh, here, he's actually acknowledging that it goes off, where everyone else will not. They want to say, this is it, and this is the truth, and forever and ever, amen. And he's saying, no, from time to time it goes off. It requires vigilance. You have to have a living conception. I thought, well, this makes more sense to me than saying it will always be perfect and it will never. He's not saying that. He's saying the opposite. So then that means, oh, then we shall have to be very vigilant and acute hearers. When we're reading, hearing from the Vaishnavas, like after the disappearance of Saraswati Thakur, some difference of opinion were among his disciples. At one point, someone was saying, you know, Prabhupada Saraswati Thakur said this, and this is, and making a case like this was an absolute statement that canceled. And Guru Maharaj said, it was, no doubt he said that. He said, but it did not cancel all the other things that he said. And a better way to understand this would be to factor in all the things that he said and then see it in relative perspective to them, instead of isolating some instruction or some statement and interpreting it as absolute and canceling all other things. After the disappearance of Saraswati Thakur, devotees were so devastated, someone said, the question among most was that, like, well, where shall we get guidance now? And so this one senior sannyasi said, he quoted the verse in the Bhagavatam, Krishne sva damo bhagate dharma jnani dibiksaha kalo nashta dushame sha puranarko duno ditaha. It says, now that Krishna has left the world and the world's plunged in the darkness, this Bhagavatam has risen like the sun illuminating all directions. Like 18,000 rays, each one of the slokas, an 18,000 rayed sun risen, giving illumination to everyone. So he was saying, now that, you know, our guru is not, we'll take our direction from the Shastra, the Bhagavatam. So some found some inspiration in that, others were not so sure. They turned to Guru Maharaj. What do you, what say you, Sridhar Maharaj? And Guru Maharaj said, we are not Sikhs. You know the Sikhs? Right. What is their primary worship? The Granth Sahib, this book. So Guru Maharaj said, we are not Sikhs. And he said, and what are the scriptures without the Vaishnava, who interprets the scriptures and reveals their relevance to us? He said, so who is the most senior Vaishnav in promoting our faith? We'll take direction from them. And they're the interpreters of the scripture. That was his response. And another man, as they toured around, he said, they came to this town and where Saraswati Thakur had visited, and this man was saying, well, you know, with all due respect to all of you disciples of his, none of you compare to him. So he was using this, so if I'm not so, you know, forthcoming and involved, you understand, I don't find anyone among you who are up to that mark or that standard of your Guru Maharaj. And Guru Maharaj said, yes, that may very well be true. He said, but you believe that he came to give something. I meant, yes, of course, you know, because you're recognizing the substance in him. So he came to distribute something in this world. He said, did he give it to anyone? Did he distribute it to anyone? He said, they may not be at the same level, but don't conclude they didn't get anything. And actually, when Guru Maharaj said it, I was happy to hear this example because I had been giving a similar example to the disciples of Swami Maharaj Prabhupada. And they say, well, there's no one like, yeah, he has no equal. But here's where the paradox comes in. You, the disciples of Prabhupada, Swami, they will say, he spread Krishna consciousness all over the world. He inundated the whole world with Krishna consciousness. Yes, Jai, Prabhupada, we say. But I'm saying, but then you say, but there's no one who's an example of someone who received that Krishna consciousness that he spread all over the world. These two things can't be true at the same time. If he spread Krishna consciousness all over the world, then there must be people who received Krishna consciousness. So when I heard Guru Maharaj give this example, I thought, yes. He's saying, so Saraswati, you're saying Saraswati Thakur, we also say he's so great, but he came to give something, to distribute something in your world. Was he successful in doing that or not? Or there's, you can't find one person who's an example of a recipient of that. No. And especially when you start talking about spread Krishna consciousness all over the world, that would seem to imply many people in many different locations all around the world received Krishna consciousness. And of course, we will concede, not to his level, but to think that they have nothing is indirectly to insult him. Or to always be tearing down those people is indirectly an insult to him. So, it's like gold. Once you know the quality of gold, wherever you see it, you will recognize it. Even as like a little bit of gold or a kilo. Right? Once you know what it is, and there are methods for, what do they call it? When you analyze gold? Assess? There's a word for it. I forget. Something like that. And I know in India, the shops, especially in Bengal, they always have a name like Lucky Narayan Babu's Gold Shop. Because the Bengalis drop some, so for Lakshmi, they say lucky. They drop the S and the M. L-A-K-H-I, lucky. So Lucky Narayan means like Lakshmi Narayan. So it's Lucky Narayan Babu Goldsmith, you know. And you go in there, and they're all on one street. All the gold, they're not in different parts of town. There's like a street, everybody's a gold merchant. On anyway, so, and I guess that's typical everywhere, but it just sometimes seems humorous to me. And say you have some piece of gold jewelry or something, and what they do, because I learned, what we call a touchstone very often is really, in Sanskrit, sparsha money, means something that transforms you. Like we say, the Vaishnava is sparsha money. By their association, you undergo this transformation. But that stone in English, or in Europe, is called the philosopher's stone, that has those transformative powers. A touchstone is a black stone that you scratch gold on, and they use that to assess its carat. So it's a little different. But, you know, look it up on Wikipedia. But I remember when they do this, they scratch it on the touchstone, they put the gold in fire, it becomes covered in this black soot, and then they wipe the soot off, and then that's when they scratch the gold. And they, oh, this is 12 carat, 14, 18, 22, 24. But they have the eyes to recognize what is gold in any amount. So it's something like that. That if we are acquainted with that substance by recognizing who is a substantial Vaishnava, then in varying degrees we will find what they have gifted, what has been their gift to the world. But if in time that devolves into something that is no longer resembles, not only no longer resembles the truth, but has almost become the opposite of that thing, then new revelation is necessary. So one of Srila Guru Maharaj's themes is, you know, substance over form. Right. One of his examples, Bengali, what is it? Na she kaj, na ni she she kaj. It's kind of funny, but it says like, the nose is working. How do you know the nose is working? Breathing. So Guru Maharaj makes it even more simple. What is more important, the nose or the breath that's going through the nose? I mean, we like to have a nose, but of the two, what is essential is the air that's going through the nose. That's what's keeping you alive. Right? Again, the emphasis on the substance within. And so many times he's hammering this point with different examples that we ourselves must become acquainted with what that substance is, lest we be deceived. And he introduced another original conception from him, the Shiksha Guru Parampara. Maybe in one line of descent, it's gone off, and the truth is moved to another. And it's moving in a zigzag way. Maybe it's not coming down in a linear way of Diksha line. But Shiksha is where the current will be traced. And regarding that current, he said, they have a saying, because sometimes, and we've seen, in Mayapur, where the devotees will soon be going, Navadvip, Mayapur, Navadvip, that when you go from Navadvip to Mayapur on the boat, you're at, there's the Jalangi and the Saraswati, Ganga, those like confluence. And a long time ago, before they had these motor boats, porpoises liked to play there. So it was almost guaranteed when you went over in the boat, you were going to see. I say porpoises because I think they're called bottlenose dolphins, the ones that swim in the Ganga. They're smaller than those big, happy ones you see. They're smaller. They're very cute also, but not so talkative. But you would see them. There's something about where the currents hit that they liked. But Guru Maharaj makes his points. He said, so they say, if another river is flowing into the Ganga, then it becomes Ganga once it's entered the current of the Ganga. And the Ganga water, if it's going somewhere else, once it leaves that current, it's something else. He's saying, so there is a saying, then what really is the Ganga? Is the current, the undercurrent that's passing through. Again, hammering this point. What is the substantial thing? That current. If it leaves this current, we're talking about line of descent. If it leaves that flow, that current, dhara, like Guru Maharaj is called the Rupanuga dhara. Dhara means who's carrying that flow, that current. If it leaves that and goes into something else, it's not that substance anymore. Then we dismiss that. If someone is in the line and that current is no longer flowing in them, then we dismiss them. Right? And at the same time, we don't deny what was there previously under the influence of that flow. There's not a contradiction there. But that current is what is vital to us, being connected with that. Yes. Does that answer the question?
Yes. Okay. Thank you, Maharaj. Question from Jai Govinda Prabhu. In the prayers of Lord Brahma to Krishna...
And to what degree shall we be able to recognize Guru Maharaj's famous example about Aurobindo Ghosh, who was, I think, the anarchist party at the time... And he had become a fugitive, so he absconded, and they don't know where he is. But he wanted to remain active, so certain articles were appearing in newspapers under different names, various pseudonyms. And this one very astute lawyer thought, I think this is him. It's not signed by him. It's not. They're not saying it's him. But to me, what I'm reading here is unmistakably him. So they have a court case, and he calls the editor of the newspaper, and he has him on, and you know, and Guru Maharaj said the pleader's name, Mr. Norton, and he's saying, "So, you are the editor of the so and so paper?"
Yes.
As the editor of the paper, you know who writes all the articles, right?
Yes.
And he's saying, by the way, what is your opinion of Aurobindo Ghosh? I think he's one of the greatest men in this nation. And I'm like, all right. And then he holds up this one article and he said, who wrote this article? And he says, I can't say. You can't, but you know who writes all the articles.
Yes.
Who wrote this article?
I cannot say.
And Guru Maharaj said, then he waved the paper to the judge and he said, here's Mr. Ghosh. His name was Aurobindo Ghosh. Here's Mr. Ghosh. So he's saying in that way, the guru, we see pictures of the guru sometimes when he was young or middle-aged or an old man or this way or that way. What is the swaroop of the guru? When that picture of Bhaktivinoda Thakur with the big beard and one Gurudev on his veranda and Kalkana, he said, and to think, he's a 14-year-old girl in Goloka Vrindavan. Like, that's not what he looks like there. So, but he's showing this form. We worship that divine form. We appreciate that. We see pictures of our guru, and it gives some joy in our heart. But Guru Maharaj, he's not a sentimentalist, ever. He says things like, Vapu must be eliminated, and everybody shudders. And what he means to say is, because someone will say, that's Mayavad. It's not Mayavad. He's saying, you have to understand the substantial thing, that divine inspiration that's passing through the Vaishnava agent, that is Sri Guru. Right? If he appears in some other form, will we recognize him? He's saying, this is not what he looked like in the picture. He's saying, but in Mahaprabhu's pastimes, when in the beginning of Chaitanya Bhagavat, and when the decision is being made to descend, just like in Krishna Leela, we're told the Guru Varga comes first. But it doesn't only mean Guru in the conventional sense, but it means mother, father, auntie, uncles, relative, you know, the elder relatives. That's called Guru Varga also. So they have to descend first. And then they're living for some time, and then the children get married, and then Gauranga Mahaprabhu, Nityananda Prabhu, others, they start appearing. But it's so beautiful and charming because he wants them to appear in different places, and it's like hide and seek, Guru Maharaj said. And everyone under the influence of Yoga Maya, they do not know where their assignments will take them. So it's sometimes said that when the Pandavas were perhaps in exile, you know, they went to many different places in India. So there's one criterion for determining whether a place is holy or not so holy, extremely auspicious or not. And they say it's either where the Ganges flows, that will always be auspicious. Where it does not flow, not auspicious. Where the Pandavas visited, not visited, inauspicious. So what's known as East Bengal, or Bangladesh now, no Ganga, and the Pandavas didn't go there. So what does Gaur Narayan, who ultimately is, you know, Gaur Krishna and Sri Krishna, Chaitanya, etc. But there also is a Vaikuntha aspect to the pastimes. What does he do? He sends great devotees to those places that were not considered the most auspicious. So Nityananda appears actually in so-called Rara Desh, which incidentally, although it looks like R-A-D, it like Radha, it's not Radha, it's Rara. It's a D with a dot under it, like Gauriamat. It's actually another word altogether. It's just turned into that in time. Devotees sometimes see that in the book and misconceive. But anyway, so in that place, the Pandavas did not visit, the Ganges does not flow, but Nityananda appeared there, Pundarik Vidyaniti, this great devotee, that great devotee. So then when it comes back to that Pandava reference, it can be massaged ontologically to be understood as saying where the Lord's dear devotees do not appear. But by having dear devotees appear there, now it's a super auspicious place. Like those who've gone to Birachandrapur, no, what's the other name? Ekachakra. Yeah. Oh, why is it? Because of the hide and seek. So they don't. Oh, this is the point I'm making. So very beautifully, remember, it's Yoga Maya, because we can say, like, how can they not know? But they don't. That makes it more like if you went to a masquerade party and someone you knew really well was so well disguised you didn't know it was them. How excited would you be when you discovered who it was? Understand? Something like that. So, so that means they're meeting even Nityananda and Mahaprabhu, like, or Nityananda and Abhiram Thakur. Because Abhiram Thakur saying, is this really Balaram? They're saying he's Balaram. He's a cowherd boy from Vrindavan, or is it Sridham, I think, or Sudham. And he remembers, I'm the fastest cowherd boy in Vrindavan. The only person who can catch me is Balaram. And he can always do it in 2.5 steps. So he's saying, is this Nityananda really that Balaram? So he starts running, and in 2.5 steps, Nityananda catches him and embraces him. And then he's like crying in ecstasy to realize this Nityananda is Balaram. Right? When Mahaprabhu and Nityananda meet, Nityananda's, he's seeing this marvelous transformation of Gauranga Mahaprabhu, of Krishna into Gauranga, and it's, he's so beautiful. Because you think, how can you improve on Krishna, whose reality is beautiful? He's inconceivably beautiful. How could you improve on that? Well, if you took Radharani and combined her with Krishna, then he said, no, that we can't bear that type of beauty. The beauty of Radharani combined with the beauty of Krishna in one, that's Gauranga Mahaprabhu. And Nityananda seeing him, and they're seeing each other for the first time in these pastimes, and Mahaprabhu indicates to Mukunda, the singer, to sing something, and he sings, Shyamam Hiranyabharidam Manabhaya Barha Datu Prabala Naravesha Navratangse Vinyastam Uttare Karnopakala Utpal, means lotus, Karmotpakalaka Mukabjahasam. I forgot somewhere, but he's saying, what does he see? He's singing the song about when the Vipra Putnis, the wives of the Yogi Brahma, they see Krishna and Balaram in the forest, and Krishna's leaning on one cowherd boy. He's twirling a lotus flower and smiling. I told, and as the lotus flower twirls, their hearts start twirling and expressing eros, the sentiments of eros. Their hearts are spinning. They're like losing consciousness, and Krishna's just smiling. That verse he quotes, because that's Krishna and Balaram surrounded by the cowherd boy. And then Nityananda faints. But he faints when he awakens. He's in the lap of Nimai Pandit. And Gadadhar Pandit starts smiling. Because he's saying, look at this. The role reversal. He always, Balaram Nityanandaram, he always likes to serve as the pillow, the couch, and now he's in the lap of his Lord, and Gadadhar Pandit cannot stop smiling at seeing how sweet this is, that he was, it's a rare instance where the Lord has defeated the devotee. Gadadhar Pandit likes that. But so they're discovering one another. And the point I mean to make is how, by their devotional tendencies, they're recognizing one another. So if our guru even did not appear in the form that we've grown accustomed to identifying them with, would we be able to recognize them if they were only exhibiting certain devotional tendencies? And how sweet a discovery that would be. And I remember once when I would get the tapes from India of Guru Maharaj's latest lectures, And sometimes there are visitors, like Yajavara Maharaj would visit sometimes, some other Maharaj, and stay with Guru Maharaj for a while. And so I'm hearing this one tape, and there's this voice, and it's very, very different. And I think, oh, maybe someone's visiting Guru Maharaj. But they're telling this, they start telling this story. And I'm listening to the story. But I'm thinking, maybe it's a visiting Maharaj. But I'm listening to the story, and it's going, and then gradually I began to realize, no, it's Guru Maharaj. Like discovering him again. And why? Was because he was very sick, had like the flu or something, and he had lost his voice, his normal speaking voice. So he was telling this story, and the voice was very unlike his normal speaking voice due to the illness. But what was told, the sweetness of what was told, and the ontological depth of what was told, was unmistakably him. So I was happy to discover him again. We know Krishna, he's playing tricks on Radharani and Brajagopis at different times. Guru Maharaj said, M1, he came as a barber, or you could say like hairstylist. And sometimes as a doctor, this, that, and out of the necessity of the pastimes, he may disguise himself. And we know when the Krishna's secretly meeting with Radharani, and one of her in-laws or relative sees her and Krishna alone and goes to tell her husband, as Prabhupada would say, her so-called husband, Abhimanyu, and say, the disgraceful, they're together right now under your eyes. And go see for yourself. And we thought, and when he goes there, he sees Radharani is worshiping Ma Kali. He's like, there's Ma Kali and Radharani. And he's saying, oh, she's so, my wife is so sweet. So how will we recognize? We hear that, you know, Hanuman, he's Hanuman, he's Bhima, he's Madhvacharya, he's Murari Gupta. All different forms from one point of view, but some, a consistency, consistent thread of devotion. And that's what we're out for, to recognize that and celebrate that. Yes, what was the question? The next question.
A question from Govinda Prabhu. He's asking...
Govinda.
Govinda Prabhu. I don't know from where, but the question is online question. Uh-huh. In the prayers of Lord Brahma to Krishna, my dear Lord Krishna, until people become your devotees, their material attachments and desires remain thieves.
Oh.
Their homes remain prisons, and their affectionate feelings for their family members remain foot shackles. So question is, just a moment. If the basis of reality is love and affection personified, mm-hmm. and his Adi Lila is the original source, how can we tell the difference between false and real affection?
Well, Adi Lila means like early pastimes. It doesn't mean original in that. It means early, like childhood, up to in Mahaprabhu's case, until he takes sannyas. But what was that? The question finally?
Finally, the question is,
if
the basis of reality is love and affection personified,
yes,
and his Adilila is the original source, how can we tell the difference between false and real affection?
Yeah, well, we have to correct. Adi Rasa is the source. There, Adi means that, right? The original. But how can we tell what is false affection?
False and real affection. Difference between them.
Yes. On the basis of what was just said, then we would have to conclude, at least generally, that real love and affection is expressed toward Krishna and his devotees, and false love and affection is expressed towards bodily connections, parents, relatives, etc. And people may not be happy to hear that, but that's kind of what the books say. And we're supposed to repeat it. Says it like everywhere you look in every book. But we don't talk about it much because it would discourage people. What does Guru Maharaj's prayer say? You know, that to Saraswati Thakur, you help me realize, you know, that family affection is a colossal hoax. But then we say, but what about if your mother, father, brother, sister, etc. are devotees? Then I think you have to be real about it. Right? What when we say love and affection, you know, these words get used a lot. We use them a lot. I do as well. But for example, when it comes to like prem, if we start using Sanskrit words, there's only Krishna prem. There's not Vishnu prem or Shiva prem or any. There's only Krishna prem or Gaur prem. There's prem is only expressed in connection with Krishna. And that means when we, you know, if we define not just love and affection, and by the, you know, just as a footnote or to calm or reassure people, we understand it's natural to have some affection for your mother, father, brother, sister, you know, that type. But we're not going to exalt that as Krishna prem, even if it's directed towards a devotee. So-called. That would be too cheap. You know, when Guru Maharaj talks about Krishna prem, when na prema gandasti darapi mehuro, he'll say that Radharani, Mahaprabhu is echoing what was expressed by Radharani. She's saying, if I had any love for Krishna, I would have died long ago. Why? She's saying, because no separation. If you really have love for Krishna, separation is impossible. If separation occurs, you will die in separation if you really have love for Krishna. And what is my situation? Being separated from him, I go on showing my face to the world. And people saying, oh, you're such a great devotee of Krishna. She's ashamed. Saying, if you really have Krishna prem, and separation occurs, you'll die immediately. That's what Guru Maharaj said. He said, because it is so, he was like searching for it, and he said, heart swallowing, heart devouring. We can't even imagine what it is properly. Right. We know in this world, sometimes we hear the Vaishnavas say, what's the closest thing in this world that that resembles love proper is the mother's love for the child. They don't say husband and wife. They say mother's love for the child is close. And why? Because there's so much self-giving and self-sacrificing involved. That's why. So even motherly affection and fatherly affection, everybody knows it's not the same. Everyone just knows this. It's like common sense that that motherly love is, you know, they'll say, no, we all know motherly love is greater than other types of love. Why? Because they sacrifice more for the child. You can't compete with the sacrifice a mother makes for her child. And don't produce one instant. No, I Googled and there was an instant, you know. No, just common sense. So, because real love is based upon self-forgetfulness and self-sacrifice, the willingness to sacrifice your happiness for another. Not la 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 love, right? Romantic love, boy girl love. We're talking about sacrifice. Willing to, you know, sacrifice your life, your body, your well-being, for another. And without expectation of remuneration in the higher sense. So, what did Guru Maharaj appreciate about, like he was saying in the beginning, that he was not so attracted to Krishna, he was more attracted to Ramachandra and Radharani. Why? He said, well, Krishna, he's the enjoyer. He's, supreme enjoyer, enjoying it. And he said, whereas Ramachandra, we seem like so much sacrifice on his part. To banish Sita is not a cruel, he's sacrificing his own happiness for the citizenry. Her sacrifice is great. And Guru Maharaj was saying, and no sacrifice represents Radharani's sacrifice. Because no one has greater love, prem for Krishna than her. So for her to accept that Krishna can depart, like we know when the Akrura is taking Krishna out of Vrindavan, the Braja Gopis are grabbing the reins. They're throwing themselves in front of the wheel. They're trying to stop this at all costs. While Yashoda's just going blind, crying tears. So for those who can't tolerate the blink of an eye, that moment of separation is intolerable to them. Right? So much that they're cursing Brahma. Atati yad bhavan anikananam trutir yugayate tamapasyatam kuntila kundalam shimukam jite yada udikshitam pakshmakrid drisham. Pakshmakrid means eyelids. So these girls, they have the audacity, they're gopi girls, they're in the lower section of society, because it goes Brahmin, Kshatriya, if you put a dividing line in the middle, then below that line would be Vaishyas, where the gopis are, and then Shudras. So they're the lower section of society, not even Kshatriyas or Brahmins. And they have the audacity to criticize the Creator. They're saying, what kind of an idiot is he? Like, he doesn't he know how to make eyes? Supposed to, like eyelids? What's wrong with him? Why do they have to blink? We're looking at Krishna and then blinking. And then we don't see him. And they're cursing Brahma for being a fool, for not having to know how to make eyes properly. They should always just be open. And one place, Radharani said, I wish I had eyes like a fish. They're just always open. They don't blink. And then you see Krishna. But you think these girls, like they're teenage, we know sometimes teenage girls, they're going, oh, they're so stupid. They're doing that, except they're talking about the Creator of the universe. He's so stupid. He doesn't know how to make eyes properly. So what separation means to them, we can't begin to imagine. We can say, and I was so attached to someone, I remember what, magnify that ad infinitum. So if you thought that was intense, magnify it ad infinitum. And then you can have a hint, a glimpse of what is Gopi Bhav. And what do we hear about the Goswami? Gopi Bhava Rasamritam Dilahari Kalolama. This is what they were absorbed in. Drowning in an ocean of Gopi Bhav, wave after wave after wave of these divine sentiments inundating their hearts. That's what was going on inside. What question am I answering?
Just a moment, Maharaj. The false and true love and affection.
Oh, right. Yeah. So,
difference between them.
Right. So, look at Rupa Goswami. Shraddha, Sadhu Sangha, the sequence, Bhajana Kriya, then Anartha Nivritti, free from misconception on one of the things, Nishta, deep rooted faith, Ruchi, some taste. At that point, he's saying there may be some taste. Taste. Then Ashakti means attachment, but the good kind. Then bhav. What is bhav? It's not even prem. It's hard to believe, but it's not. We're told that's when the seed, bhakti lata beads that sprouted and this creeper's growing, then it blossoms, it has a flower. It blossoms. And the flower has, now that flower has some aroma that Krishna finds appealing. Right? So it means like the heart, like they said, the lotus of the heart. Lotus of the heart has flowered, and Krishna's finding the aroma of that devotion charming. And that's not prem, but it's getting close. Then prem. And then divisions, you know, of prem. Sneho, man, rag, anurag, bhav, mahabhav. So those, look at what Rupa Goswami just said. We're going to take those terms and then apply it to here. That we shouldn't do. But in normal parlance, talking to people, yes, we love our mother, our father, our brothers, our sisters, our husbands, our wives, everything. It's fine. But that's not prem. That's not the love, when we say prem, what we mean. And just because the object of affection may be a devotee doesn't mean that it's that either. Let's not kid ourselves. Right? We want the real thing. And that's a goal. If someone can achieve that, we take the dust from their feet on our heads to purify ourselves. It's not, but it's, these terms are used. We say that, and we mean when we say love and with love and affection, it wouldn't sound as good in a letter or something if we said, you know, with budding love and affection, or you know, developing or burgeoning or whatever the words are, you know, on the road to love and affection, or it wouldn't have the same ring. Yeah. But we should remind ourselves not to confuse. It's there, but it's like the seeds, I think, more appropriately, of love and affection. But when we start using words like prem, how can we say that when Mahaprabhu, echoing the sentiments of Radharani, says, I don't have a scent of the fragrance of Krishna prem, what to speak of a drop? And we're told that's the proper method of approach. How much in want we are. So that want, that the lament for the absence of that substance draws remuneration in Krishna consciousness. To lament the degree of one's loss or absence of Krishna consciousness is an aspect of progressive devotion. It has value. Lamentation, this type of lamentation, has value in Krishna consciousness. And we're advised to proceed along those lines. Hare Krishna.